Hey, you're listening to the Creative Pep Talk podcast. We help you build a thriving creative career. I'm your host, Andy J. Pizza. You can stay up to date with all things Creative Pep Talk by following me on Instagram at Andy J. Pizza. Let's get into today's episode. This week's episode is brought to you by Wix.com. With Wix, the web becomes your playground. Start with a blank page and design your website in any layout you want. Work right on the web page with advanced features and sophisticated visual effects. You'll have the freedom to tell your story exactly the way that you've envisioned it. Go to Wix.com/creativepep to get started today. That's Wix.com/creativepep. Wix. What will you create? This week's episode is also brought to you by Skillshare. Skillshare is an online learning community for creators with more than 25,000 classes in design, business, and more. You'll discover countless ways to take over the universe. Basically, with your curiosity, creativity, and career, nothing's going to stop you. Take classes in social media marketing, mobile photography, creative writing, or even illustration. You could be a whole entire media company in one person with these classes. Whether you're looking to discover a new passion, start a little side hustle, or gain new professional skills, Skillshare is there to keep you learning, thriving, reaching out into the stars for those new goals. Go get 2 free months of Skillshare at skillshare.com/creativepep. You're not going to regret it. Why would you? You wouldn't. Go. This week on the show, we have my new friend, Johnny Pemberton. Yes, Johnny Pemberton. He does have a phenomenal last name, in which I am very jealous of. I'm also jealous of his hilarious natural voice. All I have to do is think about him saying something and it makes me chuckle. You might know him from the show Superstore. He's an actor on that show. He's the character Bo. He's also a voice actor. He is in the Disney XD show Pickle and Peanut. He is really good at voice acting. He freaking knocks that character out of the park and really makes that peanut come alive. I met Johnny he contacted me. His wife is an illustrator. She goes by Sleepy Brittany on Instagram. You can go check her work out. But he connected to me through Instagram and asked me to be on his podcast, Live to Tape with Johnny Pemberton. I went on that show. You should definitely go check it out. You can start with my episode. Should be warned, it gets a little feisty, a lot of ruckus, a lot of mania, weird things happen. Probably not an all ages podcast, but it's a great show. I suggest going to listen to the one where he interviews his mom. There's a good one with Tim Meadows, you know, the ladies' man. And several good episodes with Duncan Trussell from Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast and more. But I had a great chat with Johnny while I was in LA. He came over to my Airbnb and we just had a long chat about creativity, comedy, acting, and navigating those territories. And he kind of just told me a story and we pontificate about general creative career quandaries. You're going to have a great time listening to this. I refer back to this episode in lots of episodes of the show because there was just so many good, interesting takeaways, and it's from a different angle than we've really had on the show. So, you're going to have a good time. Here he is, my friend, Johnny Pemberton. I wanted to give you two heads up real quick. One, there might be some spicy language in here that you might not want your kids to hear. And then also, this is a weird thing that I felt self-conscious about later. I said something about how I have a hard time believing that I have value beyond what I can produce. And it makes it sound like I'm saying that about other people. Like I question whether people have value unless they're producing important things or what have you. But I'm really just talking about myself, whether I can feel that I have value if I'm not achieving things, and that it's a problem that I have. I hope that makes sense. Anyway, here's the conversation with my buddy, Johnny Pemberton. Thanks. Yeah. thanks for doing this, man. Thanks for coming over. How far away is this from where you are?
Medium, it's probably medium small.
Medium.
Yeah. Medium small distance.
You did the scooter. Is that like a pretty easy way?
No, I drove here.
Oh,
but when you said batteries, all right, I saw that thing parked on the sidewalk, and I was like,
you took it for a spin.
7 minutes. I'm gonna just spend $1.75 and have some fun.
Okay, so you drive around LA.
I've actually never ridden one in LA. Actually, I did in Burbank once.
Okay. But you drive your car.
Yeah, I drive.
Yeah.
I hate it.
Yeah, I'm scared of it. I don't know. I haven't done that before. This
really?
Is the first time I've ever been.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's there's so much here, it's almost like to be intimidated is to, I mean, it's just.
It feels very intimidating to me.
Yeah.
But I feel really good today, but yesterday coming in, for some reason, I was just like, this is like Oz or something.
Well, there's so many people here, and most people didn't grow up here.
Yeah.
So the chances are that any person who's having a problem is a person who is someone who is, it makes sense they're having a problem because they just moved here or.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, there's so much going on. It's really hard to, just it's hard to stick out because it's most people are trying to stick out. So.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I'm going to basically, my plan is to ask you your story because I'm going to get to that.
But, right.
Because you're basically living what I wanted to do when I was in high school.
Oh, really?
So it's very interesting to me to
That's crazy to
chat with you. But do you feel like I'm just gonna mess around on other questions first? Is there a desperation here?
I think so. I didn't realize it until I started taking acting class.
Yeah.
Because I didn't take acting class for the first couple of years I lived here. Because I was pretty much firmly all I wanted to do was comedy, like improv and stand up.
Yeah.
And there was a thing when I started, a lot of people were, I remember a friend of mine, one time someone asked him, he's a really good looking guy, and someone asked him in a coffee shop, excuse me, are you an actor? And he's like, no, I'm a comedian. Like, those can't be the same thing.
Yeah.
And I will, that
it's like
was,
a chip on your shoulder even about it.
I'm not
it.
A fucking actor.
Yeah. You can swear as much as you want.
I swear a lot.
It's totally fine. It's totally fine.
I just feel like. It's better not to sometimes.
I don't swear very much on the monologue episodes.
Yeah.
So that dads and moms can listen to them around their kids.
But you're right. I always, because my podcast, I just throw caution to the wind because I don't. At this point, if you're listening to it, your kids are fine with curses.
Right,
that's like the least of the problem.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
But
there's no problem.
That was it. I basically didn't want to. I didn't even think about being an actor. And then when I started taking acting class, because I was like, oh, I need to do something that helps you do that because you want to make money and have a job and that kind of thing. And so
when you were first doing acting though, did it feel unnatural or did you feel like you didn't know? Was that when you took that acting class, had you done some acting?
I'd done a good amount of acting. I'd taken acting classes before, but this was a class that was actually like a real acting class, not so much an acting class in terms of being good at acting, but being good at working as an actor, which I think are very different
things. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
So I took that class, and then I saw there's a side of LA I just didn't know existed, which is people who are, I would say, desperate, but less so desperate as truly delusional, like very delusional in terms of what they have to offer and the chances of them being able to do something that they. Like, there's a lot of people who can't speak English very well.
Yeah.
And if you can't speak English very well, it's going to be very hard for you to play a part of a person who is supposed to speak English well.
Yeah.
Because if you can't understand what's said and you want to act in the English language, that's like the most basic example of
sure,
that. But
there's a lot
of other stuff.
Yeah.
The people who just sort of, there's all kinds of stuff. And I just never ran into that because the comedy world, at least like the alternative comedy world that I came up in, it's just so, it's a bunch of punks who don't really give a crap about anything.
Yeah.
And they're very just dismissive of anything that tries to be that way. It's the opposite. It's just very, it's funny, and we just hang out and drink and party and just do funny stuff all the time.
Yeah.
It wasn't anything in terms of like career success was, you could see it in a lot of people who were really successful who'd come to shows, but it was something that just, it seems sort of like if you just were funny, you would eventually, if you were funny enough for long enough, you'll have success, which I still think is pretty much true.
Yeah. That's one of the things that I, when I'm thinking about, when I'm comparing illustration to the entertainment world, I'm always thinking, I would want to be a comedian or a writer actor.
Yeah.
And never just an actor, because I feel like
a raptor.
Because I feel like when you, even now, you'll listen to people on Marc Maron or whatever, these actors that have been in it, been in Mad Men, been in, you know, all these things. Yeah. And you can hear, I don't want to say desperation because it seems like mean or something, but
bitterness?
Just some kind of, or fear, just like, well, I hope I get the next gig.
Yeah.
I hope. And because acting's so intuitive, it's like, they don't even know what they're doing. So, you know, they're doing something, they don't know what it is. So it feels like there's a lot of fear and not controlling your own destiny.
There's a ton of fear.
Yeah.
And I have felt that a lot.
Yeah.
I had like a big thing, was it last year? I feel like last year in the fall, I had like a real sort of, not come to Jesus moment, but it just was, I was really feeling that. Because a big show I was on, like this huge property at Fox, it was called Son of Zorn. It got a ton of promotion. It was like a really big deal, and everyone loved it, and all these great things going for it. There was a lot of problems behind the scenes with some of the people who were the higher ups in the show and the producers, and so that's kind of, I think, why the show ended, why we didn't get a second season.
Yeah,
and it was hard because there's a lot of people in the Hollywood industry who will talk all the time about, oh yeah, this is happening, this is happening, oh, this is going to be this way.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that, a lot of talk.
Hype and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, a lot of speculation, and it's based upon nothing.
Yes.
Everyone thinks they know, and every time I've met someone who thought they knew what was going to happen, they were wrong. And so this was a case of that, and I think I bought into it either subconsciously and consciously, but I was kind
of... you thought, this is going somewhere, and
I think I kind of thought it was... So I hung some stuff on it, and then when it went away, just a couple of things happened at the same time, and I felt really out of place. I just felt placeless, because if you're working in Hollywood, that's such a huge part of your identity.
Yes.
And if you're not, it becomes really hard to kind of figure out who you are and where you're going and what you want to do, because you just, it's like you're in the dark kind of. And so, it was hard.
And I felt that plenty of times, even early on when I didn't really have a career and it was job to job and it was, you know, really scary and, you know, you'd have a slow season and panic or whatever, where now I'm in a really good place at the moment and I am really enjoying what I'm doing, but even just... you know, this one arm of the business that I'm doing, if it's slow for any reason, it could just, like for instance, every summer it's slow.
Yeah, that's
like
the same thing.
That's just
too.
The way it goes. And so every summer I'm still like, well, that's it. There's no, I can't help it. It doesn't matter if everything's going well, if everything's trending up. And there's just, and I do think there's a part of it that's like identity of like, you wrap your identity around...
You are what you do.
You are what you do. Mm-hmm. I have a really hard time with this. Not just... I have a hard time understanding my relationship to that because there's a lot of, you know, I don't know, self-care or whatever it is about, about like you have value beyond what you do. And I'm not trying to take the piss out of that. I'm just saying... I have mixed feelings about that. And I'm just being honest.
Oh,
that's probably true.
I think there's a big disconnect between intellectualizing something and honestly feeling it.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
I can intellectualize almost all of that stuff, any kind of self-care stuff I can be. Yes, that does make sense. That's true.
Yeah.
But actually not doing it is a different thing. It takes a lot more practice than sometimes I am willing to do.
Yes. And I think there's like a philosophy side of it where I want to say, I get skeptical and I'm like, why? What does that mean? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, you have value beyond what you do. And I think, do you? I know this is terrible. This is not, I almost don't want this.
But no,
record,
I agree. I think there's a duality to it.
There
is a thing where you are dust, you're a piece of crap, you're nothing, you're just a turd floating in the universe that has intrinsically no value whatsoever.
Right.
But there's also the other side of it where you are completely unique and everything you do is a light on into darkness. So it's like that, it's that duality of things. I always feel like it's how isn't I'm just thinking about things in terms of like a, from a Buddhist perspective, I suppose.
Yeah.
Where, okay, I mean, I've said this from a very, what do you call it? It's like when someone doesn't know much about it, like an armchair Buddhist philosophy.
Armchair expert,
But I always think about something. A good friend of Duncan, a good friend of mine is this guy named Duncan Trussell.
I know of Duncan. Yeah, Duncan's, and he's awesome.
We're talking. This is years ago, but I think about it all the time. We were in some city, Northern California, for a comedy festival. And I was talking about how nice it is here, all these like buildings and stuff like that. And I can't remember what he said, but basically he was telling me there's some Buddhist quote about blah 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 blah. But I can assure you, the world is on fire.
Right.
And I always think about that.
Right.
Especially now, because so many people, it's very popular to talk about like, oh, the way things are now, man. Sure. Oh, things being so bad right now.
Outrage. It's like culture.
Dude, you're full of it because it's not. Everything is not so bad right now.
Right.
Everything is actually great.
Comparatively to almost any other time in history.
In human history.
Human,
there's more people living, less people dying from abscesses, all kinds of stuff. But the problem is, it's like this perspective that becomes like almost, honestly, a fashionable attitude to have like this sort of I can never say the word right, but it's the echelon. When someone thinks that the world's going to end.
Uh-huh.
That's a fashionable thing.
True.
It's also inherently selfish because the idea that, oh, dude, we're the last generation.
Yeah, it's like ego.
What a selfish thing to think. Yeah. Oh, wow, we're the last ones to be here, man. We're so cool.
Yeah.
Wow, I can't believe the world's
It's going to end on our.
The Earth's going to be destroyed by climate change probably in 4 years.
Yeah.
It's like, no, it's not, actually. There's going to be a lot of bad stuff, but it's definitely not the end days. People have been thinking the world's going to end.
For as long as people are alive.
And so I think about that Buddhist quote about how you can say whatever, everything can be great, but I can assure you that the world is on fire. It's everything is burning. And so that's being said by someone who is probably smiling, like a Buddhist monk who's, hey, everything's terrible, but I'm happy because I'm alive and I don't really care. So I always think about that in terms of just, it's almost like a nihilistic viewpoint, but I think there's a lot of hope in nihilism to some extent.
Yeah, and fatalism, I think there is. And one of the difficulties, I want to swing back to the value thing in a second, but one of the difficulties of doing this podcast for me is I'm constantly putting out my opinions and point of view on stuff, and most of my point of views are dual. So like everything that I...
Are you a Gemini?
I'm not.
I am. No. It's like an excuse. Yeah,
right, that's the excuse. but that whole like I am. I almost feel like just two people living in the same body often. And actually, I get tons of peace from it. I get tons of peace from being all in on science and also a mystical weirdo. And just I don't see them. I see it less as dual and more as there's a word for it. I don't know, but
like
whatever it means.
Theory or something.
Yeah, both and like it. They can both be true. And most of the mystic stuff I kind of think of as metaphor, but whatever. Anyway.
Yeah, I feel the same way.
Yeah, you do. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, so I just want to say one other thing.
Yeah.
As we're thinking about this inherent value, I do think marriage does make me feel that way because one of the things I think is really interesting is. Sophie has never listened to, my wife has never listened to an episode of the podcast.
Really? Is that on purpose?
No, she just doesn't want to.
Okay.
and I think, and I'm not saying there's not a good or bad here, whether she should or shouldn't, but I do feel like my relationship to her and my value to her is literally just being. It's like, she just likes my essence and she wants me to be around. And I feel the same about her. Like if she was sick or, you know, whatever, and she couldn't do anything, I would still be...
You wouldn't like her more.
No, I wouldn't. Yeah, I wouldn't like her any less if it wouldn't be fun. I don't want to. You know, I wouldn't want to just take care of her all the time, whatever. What I like about her is just that she exists.
That makes sense. Yeah, it's almost. Yeah. It sounds like it's a dumb comparison, but I mean that's how dogs love people too. There's just a thing where
totally true. Yes.
Give a shit. Oh, you murdered someone? Well. Yeah. Where's that food? Is the food coming?
Yes, and I do feel like that.
Get that scoop out.
Yeah. So let's go to your, when did you, because last time we talked, you talked to me a little bit about like high school and whatever. Right. What year did you come to LA?
I think 2005.
Okay, 2005.
I think it was, I always get confused because I moved, I think, the beginning of the year.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it was 2005 or 2006, but I think it was January of one of those years.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
And so what did you do? I just want to hear, how did you get, because to me, I don't know what your perception of your life is, right? But to me,
I don't know either because I'm inside of it.
Exactly. Right, maybe. Yeah, that's true. But to me, you know, I'm looking at all the things that you've done. And I think to anybody outside the entertainment world, it just looks like an incredible feat.
It's a lot. It's a lot of good. A lot. Checked some boxes.
Yeah.
Checked a good amount of boxes.
Yes. So to me, I'm just like, how did you do that? What did you, what were the steps? And maybe they're not something someone could follow. I'm just literally interested in how it played out.
I mean, I moved here in that year because I got a job. Some friends of mine who I went to college with, they moved out here 6 months. They graduated 6 months, a semester ahead of me. I took a semester off of college because I had to have abdominal surgery. I had my large intestine removed. Colitis. I got colitis when I was about 10 years old and had it for, you know, about 15 years, I guess. No, I had it for about maybe 12 years.
Yeah.
And it's a thing when you have colitis, which is a disease of the large intestine colon.
Yeah.
The longer you have it, and if it's not responding to drugs, your chances of getting colon cancer just like triple every year.
What?
And colon cancer is like a super treatable cancer, but also if you don't catch it early and it spreads, it's just like, oh, you just died because of something that was could have been prevented, which would be terrible, obviously.
Yeah, that sucks.
So I was advised to have surgery because the younger you are when you have surgery, the faster you recover from it, just because, you know, your body's younger.
So, yeah, yeah.
I decided to do that. I think I skipped my first semester of my sophomore year at school in Florida State. I skipped it. It's like Carol Channing right now for some reason. That's the hack. How to sound like Carol Channing. Just do sh instead of s.
Yeah.
So I did that. And so that set me back from graduating by one semester.
Right.
And so all my friends who I was really close with, they graduated a semester earlier. A couple of them moved to LA just because, I don't remember why, but they did. Because we all studied media production, which is basically like TV.
Okay.
Sort of in school. Which also means nothing, because I think I learned I learned what I didn't know,
basically. Yeah.
Okay. Learned how to goof off and fool around and stuff.
Right.
So they did that, and I had a health issue, right?
Mm-hmm.
And my dad was insistent that I have health insurance because he was like, you know, I was so ready to move to Chicago to study at Second City because that's where I wanted to go. Move to Chicago, study at Second City, play in this band I played with. I played in a band called Isabella Pearl with a couple girls I lived next to in college.
Yeah.
And I wanted to keep playing the band and just study comedy, like study improv at Second City, because that's where all my heroes, they studied there.
Yeah.
And so I was going to move to Chicago.
I wanted to do that, too.
What's that? Oh, yeah.
I thought about awesome. It. Yeah.
I mean, I think it's kind of Ben had now. I think that,
sure, it's a different
yeah,
era.
It's a different thing. Yeah. But I wanted to do that, but I couldn't get a job in Chicago. My dad was like, you have to have health insurance. If you don't have health insurance and you have this bad disease, let's say you have to have emergency surgery, you could like basically bankrupt. It would be such an expensive amount of money.
Yeah.
Be very expensive to the point where I think my parents would be forced to pay for it because they can.
Right.
This is before they had that thing, the insurance clause, where up until they changed it right after I turned 26, where up until 26 you're under your parents' insurance.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was on my own.
Yep.
So dad's like, you got to have a job. Even though if I was a badass, I would have just been like, screw you, dad. I'm just going to do it anyways. Yeah. If I have a problem, we'll just deal with it.
Yeah.
So I ended up like making this big chart. Like, should I move to New York? I had a lot of friends in New York. Should I move to Chicago?
You made a chart?
I made a chart, like pros and cons.
That's awesome.
I was in the basement in Minnesota after I moved home to Minnesota after I graduated from college. Made the chart. And I ended up actually making the chart, being like, okay, I think it's going to be Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
And then I got a call from my friend Mark, who lived in LA. He was saying how, because he worked at Fox, the movie TV studio,
right,
doing something that is not even a job anymore because they don't have enough money to hire people to do nothing.
Right.
So he was getting moved up, but he was getting promoted, and they needed someone new to do this like the most menial job at Fox.com,
uh-huh,
the website. And so I was like, oh yeah, that'd be awesome. And I interviewed on the phone with some guy named Miles, wonderful man, and I got this job. It was being a viral marketer. Which this is like, this is 2005, right? So this is before the internet was really what it is now. What,
true. What yeah. it meant. It was a totally different thing, yeah.
Oh, man. It was like no one went to that website. Nobody. Because people didn't go to, like, oh, I want to, let's go to the fox.com/bones and check out the content on there.
Yeah.
Check out this beautiful, slick website that some college graduate designed that, I mean, it probably had like triple digit views a month, maybe less.
What?
So I worked there doing, like, I would seed message boards with the Times.
Yeah.
Like, hey guys, it's me. Like, they have these accounts on different message boards.
Yeah.
They were not real accounts. They were run by Fox. So I got this booklet of passwords and names.
What in the world?
It was the dumb. It's the kind of thing where, looking back, I can't believe I got paid to do this.
Yeah.
So I had a full-time
job.
I didn't have insurance, but I had made enough money to where I could buy health insurance.
Right. Okay.
Privately, which is the most expensive thing in the goddamn world.
It's so ridiculous.
Holy crap.
It's so ridiculous. One of my big goals long-term would be to help freelancers or people that are self-employed, creative people, some kind of services around taxes and healthcare, because it is, to me, it almost feels like a conspiracy made by corporations to keep keep talent in. To be like, let's make this so difficult. I hate it. So anyway,
it does. I mean, even that place, I was a subcontractor the whole time I worked there.
Right. Yeah.
And so that's that's what got me out here, essentially. Right. Was that job.
Sure. Yeah.
Moved out, lived in a one bedroom apartment with two other guys for about 6 months.
Yeah.
Which was both awesome and terrible.
Right. Yeah.
And then I moved into a two bedroom with one other dude, on Hollywood, right off Hollywood Boulevard, and I had a job for, I guess, like almost 2 years, maybe a year and a half. And that's when the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater opened up on Franklin, probably like months after I moved there.
Right.
I can't remember. It was really close after. And I was obsessed with that TV show when it was on Comedy Central.
Yeah.
And I really wanted to go to the theater.
Were they always in L.A.? Or
no,
were they
in
New York?
Started in Chicago.
Oh, okay.
At the Annoyance Theater. And then they opened their own theater in New York.
Okay.
And they opened a second theater in New York, and they opened one in L.A.
Yeah,
and,
right, okay.
Yeah, so I just really wanted to learn, because I know those guys studied with Del Close.
Uh-huh.
So I wanted to learn their brand of improv. So I just took the first class they ever offered there.
Can I just interrupt you real quick? I know Del Close just from people talking about her, but...
Do people say you look like him?
He's a guy? I don't know. I just know
the name. You look kind of like Del Close, for real.
I definitely read an interview with him. Didn't know it was a guy. But I've heard comedians talk about him. Can you tell me more about who that is? I know that they always talk about, like, the Del Close method of improv or whatever. But, yeah, tell me about that.
I don't know a whole lot about him. All I know is that he was in the Merry Pranksters, which is that Ken Kesey group.
Yeah.
That used to travel around in, like, San Francisco, and take acid and do like street theater and he was like a hippie, but not like a normal hippie, like an acid hippie, like a kind of he was an aggressive spiritual artist, I guess.
Huh.
I don't really know a whole lot about his life, but I know that he started developing improv. I think they call the form he developed the Herald, just a way to do an hour-long improv show.
Yeah.
It involves like certain types of scenes, arrangements of scenes, and building them. And he, I think, is sort of credited with the idea of not thinking about what you're doing, sort of like just doing it in a reactionary way. I think maybe he's also yes and. I think maybe he's also the idea of working from the top of your intelligence.
Mm.
There's a bunch of stuff. I think some
That's this idea
where when you're doing something, you don't want to ever handicap yourself. So you always come do the smartest thing you know to do in the moment.
Okay.
You don't pretend not to know something.
Right.
I mean, obviously, you are pretending not to be, to say, oh, we're not actually doing a scene right now. We're two actors talking on the stage. You don't do that. I guess that wouldn't be considered intelligence, but it's the idea where if you know all the 50 capitals, it's okay. You should always. I feel like I've never taught improv, so I don't I'm not like good at like describing that stuff. But okay. I think
I'm just super curious. It doesn't matter. I've never heard it, so your version is the best version I've ever heard.
You're supposed to just play at the top of your intelligence, like you are. When you're doing improv, you want to be not handicapping yourself in any way. You want to be working with everything you've got, And sometimes some people just have a lot of knowledge, specific knowledge about certain things, and then all that can do is help. Because it just adds all this color and texture and specifics mm-hmm. to things.
Yeah.
And it can really give your scene partner something to latch onto, like a detail. Like if I were to say a word wrong or just say something very specific, that's something that someone else would notice, and that can become the first snowflake of the snowball.
Uh-huh.
Which so much of that stuff, so much of improv, I mean, I feel like group improv is kind of going through a tough place right now. I'm not really into it, but a lot of people talk a lot of shit on it.
Uh-huh.
And for good reason. There's most of it's bad.
Yeah.
And most people who do it are bad and annoying and like oh my God, just stop.
All right.
Please. Like we're having breakfast. Just can not do this, whatever this improv game is.
You're saying right now?
Yeah. It's some of that, but and its core, I think it's a great thing. And it's also, it's not limited to improv, doing improv with other people.
Because
I started doing stand-up, and I feel like I use that stuff in my stand-up all the time, and to the extent where I think there's a lot of lines being blurred between what is stand-up comedy and what is improv and what is sketch, because it kind of doesn't really matter to some extent.
Do you, one thing that you said about not thinking...
Yeah.
Sometimes I wonder, you know, some of these comedians that get into massive trouble, whatever, massive trouble by the culture. I wonder sometimes, because I know when I'm going to, even if I'm just doing a talk, because I do a lot of talks, and I know my best talks are when I'm not thinking.
Yeah.
I'm just, and then I think.
Flow state.
Yeah. But don't you, it's no wonder that these people get in trouble when you're not thinking. And you're just letting it happen. Does that make sense? Like
it does. I also think a big part of it is a lot of people don't realize. What do you call people who don't? Not lay people. What do you call someone like commoners? Just people who
like a civilian.
Yeah, civilian.
That's kind of
normies.
Right. Yeah.
They don't understand the pressure that you have when you're on stage. They also don't understand how easy it is to get very defensive. Because if you are up on stage and something's going wrong, or someone's, if I'm ever been heckled by someone, and I not so much defend myself, but like have to deal with them,
yeah.
have to like babysit this adult drunk,
yes.
who's being a piece of crap,
yeah.
and doesn't realize it, you have to babysit them. Even if you're doing it in the most gentle way, your blood starts to run hot. Because
now now you're in the part of your brain that's fight or flight,
uh-huh.
and you're gonna be doing. You're not thinking clearly.
Fight.
Yeah.
And sometimes I've fought people, not physically, but it's been this thing where I come off stage and I'm shaking because I'm just so angry at this person because it's not just they're not wasting my time. They're wasting everyone's time.
Everybody in that room's time.
And everyone hates them. If you're a heckler, everyone hates them.
Yes.
There's almost never been a heckler. It's happened maybe. I don't know, once ever, where people are like, oh, this heckler's good. Yeah.
but I think about how, do you ever worry about when you're doing, this is a weird thought maybe, but when you're not thinking and you're performing, do you ever worry that what's in your head?
I guess all the time, and also not.
Okay.
I just think I worry that I'm going to get so defensive that I'm going to, because sometimes I think people get in trouble, it's because they're so defensive that all they want to do is hurt the person who was hurting them.
Yeah.
And they're not speaking from a place of intelligence or how they actually feel.
Or what they feel. That's the thing,
They're like a cornered rat.
Yes.
They're just going to bite whatever comes near them because they think they're about to die.
Yeah.
There's a reason people say that fear of public speaking is the number one fear in the world.
Yeah.
So if that's the case, when it goes to stand the, that people who are doing that are going to have a very intense fear if things are...
If it's going bad?
Yeah, the tables are being turned. You become
it's like my worst nightmare.
Totally. Because
I've gone through, earlier in my career especially, I had a few talks go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I do talks all the time, and I'm still petrified. Before I do it, I mean, I love doing it.
Yeah.
But I still get petrified because I'm like, I know what it feels like when it's not working.
Right.
And it is brutal.
It can be.
Yeah.
It can be brutal. It can be very brutal also, but it also can be a thing where sometimes that's the best.
Right.
Is when you have things are going wrong and you address it and deal with it. It's like you just saved the plane crash.
Yeah.
And you're even better. Like we love a person who saves a plane We love the pilot who saves the plane crash more than the pilot who just got us there.
Got us there, yeah. Totally true. Yeah. Do you, another question, I'm going to go back to the story, but do you, one of the things that I think a lot about is I panic so much about going up there, but then once I'm up there, I feel like it's the best version of my brain.
Yeah.
Like, it's the clearest, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm so much quicker when I'm on stage than I'm not. Do you find that?
Oh, 100%. To the point where sometimes I get frustrated that I can't think that way otherwise.
What is that?
I think it's the simplest explanation is it's just your primitive brain.
That's what I think.
All of a sudden kicking in. It's the same reason.
It's like, get it together. Use everything.
You're getting endorphins. You're getting like, what's it called? The adrenaline. You get adrenaline.
Yes.
You get all that stuff because before that, you're just essentially... you're in peacetime.
Quick shout out to our sponsors. We're excited about our sponsors. We have Wix.com. Here's the thing about Wix. They are freaking there for these creative people. They've tried to make the best possible tool for creating websites for creatives. You need a portfolio. You need to show that you're really in on this thing, that you're there to make a living, and you got to do so with a professional website. You don't want someone to search your name and all they can find is the Tumblrs and the Instagrams and the Twitters and the Flitters and the Swatters and the Fodders. You need to find Wix.com/creativepep. Get started. Get tinkering. You can do it for free. Just start messing around. Plug in some of your jazz, your musical notes, your pictures, what have you. Put them on there. See what happens. See if you like what you're seeing. I think you will. Go check it out. Creative Pep Talk. No, that's not the website. It's Wix.com/creativepep to get started today. Wix.com/creativepep. Wix. What will you create? We are also sponsored by Skillshare. Skillshare is an online learning community. What does that mean? It means you can go on there and watch videos and get better, learn some things, improve. I'm telling you this right now. The person you see in front of you right now isn't me because you're listening to a podcast, you idiot. You're so dumb, you probably need to go watch some of these videos. I know I was that dumb, but I'm not anymore because I watched the videos. Here's what I'm really trying to tell you. Go to Skillshare. You can get 2 free months free by going to skillshare.com/creativepep. Here's the thing. There's a video on there, Be Your Own Boss. It's a series of videos. It's a class, if you will. Be Your Own Boss, Strategies for Launching Your Creative Career by Martina Flohr. And she's going through things like the right mindset, pros and cons, be your own client. You know, I'm down for that. Finding clients, how you introduce yourself, showcasing your work, all that good stuff. I highly recommend it. Looks like a really great class. Go check it out. It's very perfect for this podcast. You know, I wouldn't be where I am today, honestly, if I hadn't continued learning. Literally, the person I was 10 years ago is nothing compared to the person I am now. And I owe so much of that to a continual obsession with improvement and growth and learning. And lots of that learning came through online videos, literally many of them coming from Skillshare. So go check it out, skillshare.com/creativepep to get started today. You got nothing to lose. You got 2 months for free. Check it out. So let's go back. So you were, go back to where do you remember where you left here?
Well, I was working at Fox.com doing almost nothing.
You started to do?
I started taking improv. I think UCB? I started doing stand-up too, yeah.
Okay, what was that like?
Well, the first time I ever did stand-up was really bad.
Uh-huh.
It was really bad.
Really? Tell me about it.
Okay, what? So.
Tell me that story, yeah.
It's so bad. It's such a good story. It's actually like a really great story. There was this web talk show that Fox.com decided to do to promote shows internally.
Yeah.
I can't remember what it was called or anything. It was a dumb thing. It was some dumb thing that no one was ever going to watch.
Yeah.
Excuse me. We decided to it was like an actual talk show they were going to film with 3 cameras. There was a guy in the department who was just a writer in the department named Michael.
Yep.
He was going to host it. And he, we set it all up and wrote it and had all this. I was one of the people who helped write it. And we filmed the thing in some studio in the Deep Valley. And I was like, I'll do warm-up for the crowd. Because it's, and I think I've...
Have you done that before?
I've never done that. I've never done stand-up before. But I wanted to do stand-up. I've been writing a lot of jokes. I've been thinking about it. Because I've been thinking about doing stand-up for years. Actually, I kind of done some stand-up. in someone's living room a couple times my last year in college.
Right.
So that was like a year ago, maybe.
Okay.
A year prior to that.
Yeah.
And I had done, and that was great. That was killing, but it was also literally behind someone's couch with a lamp like pointed up, and that was really fun.
Yeah, that's cool. Awesome. Yeah.
It was super indie. So I'm like, oh, I'll have such a great experience with this. Yeah. Also, it's a paid audience, so that means they're definitely going to laugh.
Oh my gosh.
Which I didn't know is the opposite.
The opposite of true, yeah.
It's the opposite of that.
That's probably the number one reason I didn't go into comedy was the idea that there's nothing harder than saying, okay, and this guy's going to come up and be funny.
Yeah.
Any other situation, it's pretty easy to be funny.
Yeah.
Like, if you're, whatever you are, if you're just a little bit funny of any other profession, you're hilarious.
He's crushing it.
Yes.
Wow, so, this dentist is funny.
Yeah. So, anyway, all right, so what happened?
I decided I would do that, and I wrote my jokes down. I wrote out a bunch. I rehearsed them, what I thought to be a lot, but it was obviously not any amount at all. No. Basically, right. And I go up there. I'm going to do like 6 or 7 minutes to open the show. Some like big sound, some little soundstage, probably in Van Nuys or something. Probably where they shot porn, for real. Right, probably was actually a place they shot a lot of porn. And I go up there, and I'm doing my stuff, and I've never really done stand-up before, so except for that time in the guy's house in Tallahassee, Florida, after like 6 beers. Yeah. I go up there sober.
How are you feeling before you go up?
I don't even know.
You don't remember?
I think I was really nervous, but I didn't know enough to be nervous as I should have been.
Super. Yeah.
I go up there and I just bomb like an amazing amount. It's like an amazing bomb. It's crickets. For some stuff is pure crickets. And some stuff is one guy who happened to be from Minnesota who's like, yeah! I didn't know how to react to someone I just didn't know how to do any of it.
Right.
I had no idea how to do any of it. Right. And the best thing was that one of the guests on the show was Dana Gould. You know him? He's a comedian. He wrote for The Simpsons for like forever.
Okay.
Super funny comedian. Like he's so funny and so dark too. Great guy. He was a guest on the show. And I think he may have seen me perform or not. The biggest thing I remember about that show was, well, one thing, the host, Michael, sold me out to get laughs, and it was good. He should have done that.
Right.
Because he had to cut the tension, obviously, because what the hell is this crap that just sprayed all over us here? So he did that, and got a bunch of laughs.
What did he say?
I don't know. I don't even remember, but just make fun. All right, so that was something you're not going to see every day. Hopefully not, right? Just sold me out,
just
right?
Come under
the bus, the bus got a nice jolt for throwing me under. So there's another thing that happens when you bomb that miserably is no one will make eye contact with you.
Yeah. I've been there.
Yeah. And that's a cool thing. It's just a thing where, wow, because you become this icky, like, diseased person.
Like, don't touch, like, stay back. I don't want that.
Yeah.
Especially that's a primal thing, too.
Super primal.
Yes.
It's totally primal. It's why, like, chimps kill a sick chimp.
Yeah.
It's not because they don't like it. It's because you're bringing us down.
Yeah. And there's and I think that there's even a thing of, like, the person that's ostracized socially is, like, trouble. And and that's why I feel like it's so painful, is that your brain takes in, like, rejection from the tribe. It feels like death because it was death.
Yeah.
So
for real.
Yeah, it's intense.
I felt
it's a terrible feeling.
The talk show went great. Obviously, now it's something that probably couldn't even be discovered on the internet if you tried.
Right, sure.
And afterwards, me and the main guy, Michael, and our friend Haley, we all went out to dinner, I think, someplace around here, actually. And the weird thing is, I didn't feel that bad.
Huh.
It was one of those things where somehow I was able to laugh at how bad it was.
Yeah.
And also realize, okay, that was really bad, but I wanted to keep doing this because I think I just have to find a way to get better at this. Because obviously, I feel like I was not an unfunny person. I know that.
Right.
I just know have to figure out how to do this. And the cool thing about that is Haley was dating a comedian at the time named Peter Sprite. Mm. And Peter, put me in contact with him, and he is like a saint. Like, the older I get, the more I realize.
This is the guy that helped you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's like I talk about on my podcast.
Yeah,
right?
We talked a little
bit
about
it. He helped me like rewrite my jokes, trim them down. He actually put me up on his show. It was every month at the Comedy Store in the Belly Room. And I did a show there for the first time after that, and I was nervous as hell.
Yeah, that time.
I think I even smuggled in a bunch of beers because I was so cheap. I had no. I brought a backpack full of Heinekens wrapped in socks. I think I was drinking them. I think I drank 3 or 4 Heinekens. I was pissing like every 4 minutes.
Yeah.
And I went out there and did maybe 6 minutes, and I just crushed.
Yeah.
And I think I have it on tape of it. You can see my face. My face is not prepared for this to go well.
Yeah.
I am just.
They're like, oh.
Oh, my God. What's going on?
Oh, man. That's amazing. I just crushed
so hard.
Yes.
It was crazy.
Yeah.
Afterwards, I think the host's face is literally just aghast.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what the hell?
What's going on?
And I didn't have any idea what went on either. I just was just doing. It just I happened to have worked on my comedy stuff.
Yeah.
And I did it to a room of people who were actually receptive to comedy. The Belly Room is one of the greatest places in the world to perform.
Mm.
It's where Chappelle did that second half of his special for a reason. It's just like this perfectly intimate. So it was so good. And after that, it was just where, okay, I have to keep doing this.
Yeah.
I've bombed many, many, many times since that first time killed, but it was enough to give me like a taste of like, wow, this is so sweet. I can't believe how
sweet
this is.
Yeah, it's like that first, I'm not saying it was beginner's luck, but that kind of feeling of you get
totally
a little
was.
Taste of like what it could be, and you're like, okay, I'm gonna. And I wonder also like, because I know sometimes people will say something like, well, I'm not natural at this or that like you are.
Yeah.
And I think, I'm not natural at that. Or there is an inkling of a natural thing going on, but it's the time and energy and obsession that I've, you know, done to do that, pushing past those experiences like that.
And right.
Or
if someone's a natural, they'll say like, oh, you're a natural at baseball. It's like, I guess I am. Oh, also my dad was a baseball player and I grew up playing baseball since I could walk.
Yeah.
So yeah, you're a natural, but it's because you've always been thinking that. I think a lot of people who are quote unquote naturals at comedy, people who either started really young or their just life was so messed up that they're always trying to find humor in situations. Otherwise, they would just fall down this black hole of negativity. Yeah. So they just are always joking. Like, I was always joking about everything. I would just make fun of everything all the time, get kicked out of class, or just ride the line of, if I make my teacher laugh, she won't kick me out.
Yeah, right.
But she'll want to kick me out, but she won't. It's like
but
that fine line
enough.
Of, can I say this one more time?
Yeah.
And she'll laugh, and she's like, stop it. Like, it's like that kind of thing. So
yeah.
I was always just
what was
messing
it for
around.
You? That why were you joking around, do you think? Have you thought
about
that?
I don't know.
I
think probably because I was sick. Probably because I had bad, you know, bowel problems. And if you have a bowel problem, it's not cool to talk about because it's farting, it's pooping.
Yeah.
It's super embarrassing.
So it's embarrassing,
I think that's probably what it was. But also, I don't even know. It just was...
It's also a neurological thing.
Yeah.
Like there's your brain either makes those connections or it doesn't. There's a little bit of that. Like it's... You know, there's certain brains that aren't going to be making jokes no matter what. No situation, no amount of learning, you're not going to be doing it. So you had some kind of predisposition for that, too.
I just wanted it all the time. I just always wanted to just be stupid.
Yeah.
Something about being, time disappears if you're being stupid, having fun, doing something that's pointless, but it feels so good.
Yes.
That I don't know. I mean, I still can't explain it to this day. I just love it so. It just feels so good. I always think about that Hank Williams Jr. lyric where he says, "I'm into feeling good, and I don't like some. How am I gonna butcher it? But he basically says, I like being happy, and I don't like sad. Like what a great way of saying.
Like, yeah.
Sometimes I realize that. Like, wait a second. I don't like being sad.
Yeah.
Being serious. Sometimes I'll. Get in my head and start to be like, oh, I have to be serious. I have to be serious here. I have to be like I'm a paid actor here. We have to be serious about this stuff.
Yeah.
And I feel bad. And then I realize, oh, wait, I hate this.
Yes.
I hate being serious.
Yeah.
It feels like gross. It makes me just feel like I'm swimming or something. like swimming, and I don't want to be swimming. Yeah. Like swimming with my clothes on.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, take these clothes off.
Good. I like that. It's weird for me because there was, up until like 17, I was like comedy all the time.
Uh-huh.
Complete goofball at school all the time. And I don't know, there's a lot, I mean, there's probably explanations, but At that point, I almost went the opposite way into Sirius. And I do think I like to spend most of my, it's weird, but I like to spend most of my time thinking and talking about serious things.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know if that comes across or anything, but that, yeah.
That's cool.
It's a weird thing. Anyway, okay, so how did you go? So you started doing UCB classes?
Yeah, I was taking an improv class.
Yeah, okay. What did you say?
I said, yeah, I was taking an improv class.
Yeah.
I said in some
yeah,
way.
I was taking improv.
I was taking improv class. Yeah, say improv. Yes, I know, Kyle.
So you were taking classes. You're doing stand-up. Mm-hmm. And how do you start getting roles and such?
I think the first role I ever got was on a show on Starz Channel called Hollywood Residential. And back at the time, UCB was kind of hip. I mean, it's become way more hip in a way that's not hip.
Like it's very mainstream now.
Yeah, now it's
everybody
it's
almost knows about it. Yes, yeah. It's like a common, used to be all these comedy scenes were kind of only known to comedians. Nobody even knew how people ended up on Saturday Night Live.
Right.
You know, the general public didn't at least. But now everybody knows.
Back then it was actually underground and actually very, it was just hip. It was a bunch of hipsters.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of casting directors who are just, casting directors are some of the coolest people ever. Because they just like watching stuff. They love just watching people just do their thing. And this one group, I can't remember which casting group it was, but they were kind of hip to that. And this was a show that was partially improvised, the show was. And so they brought in everybody. They bring in the whole damn, anyone who's ever performed at UCB. I don't know how, I didn't have a manager at this point, I think. They just brought in everybody.
Yeah.
Because it's easy. They do it a lot of times. They'll just have like tell the theater to send us people who fit this description. So I went in, and I think, I just went in. I was waiting in the lobby with everyone. We were just joking. I didn't know my lines. We just barely. I didn't know you had to memorize them. I just thought like, oh, you can just kind of, you know, it's improvised. I'll just wing it.
Yeah.
So also wasn't that much to know anyways. I went in there, and I think she asked me, how old am I? And I was like, because people always ask me that because I look so young.
Yeah.
And I would obviously resent it and hate it because it's anything where, like, stop asking me this person who's younger than me. Stop asking me if I'm old enough to be older than you.
Yeah.
And she asked me how old I am. And I said, old enough to drink, but not old enough to rent a car.
Right.
And then she got pissed because I didn't answer her straight. She's like, you have to tell me how old you are or we can't read you. And then someone said, actually, you know, you can't ask them that. Because there's a thing, I guess you can't ask an actor how old they are.
Thing?
It's a legal thing in SAG.
You can't ask.
I didn't know that. And she said that, you actually don't have to. He just has to be over 18. She's like, are you over 18? I'm like, yeah. And then I read it, and some reason I think because I was such a little punk. I was being such a little bastard to them by talking back that kind of activated them. And I just booked this tiny part. Playing like a PA on this show. It's a show about a show. It was a show about a guy who had a handyman show.
Uh-huh.
And I play this tiny part where I get a saw blade flies off and sticks me in the leg. And I'm like, I'm sorry. Like just super, super stupid thing. But that was the first thing I ever got.
Yeah. You think talking back to them made them respect you or something?
Totally.
Is that what you're saying? Yeah, that's
because
interesting.
Because so many people go into auditions and they're so...
desperate?
They're so like... They're so, what's the word? Like, it's not slovenly.
Subservient.
Which I think you also do have to have an element of.
Right.
But there's just this element of such preciousness. And so they feel so intimidated by these people that they're not able to be themselves. And they're not able to bring something there that is what they want. Like, basically, I mean, I remember learning years later about how Fellini, the director, he's notoriously kind of difficult with actors,
mm-hmm.
but he also loves actors because he loves to watch actors play.
Yeah,
it's a thing where he loves to watch people be in a way he can't be. So it's this thing where
like a fascination.
Yeah. It's like the same way you watch animals as people. We're like, oh,
look what they're doing.
Yeah, it's not really aware of its
thing.
And I think it's the same way with most directors and casting directors and people who are making something, They want a person who is not being, not doing something with awareness. They're doing it because of through the joy of it.
Uh-huh.
And if you do something through the joy of it, I kind of think that being a punk, being sort of like talking back, is a joyful expression, because it's kind of, it's this thing where you're poking at something to see what happens.
Right.
And if you have the balls to poke at something,
yeah,
some people won't like it, but a lot of times people who do, they really like it.
Uh-huh.
And that's, I've just always done that on auditions, not sometimes cognizantly, but sometimes it's just
who you
how
are
I am.
Anyway.
Yeah. Because I just want to have fun with it.
Doesn't surprise me.
And I just can't stand when stuff is boring, so I want to find a way to
make it. I hate boring. We have that in common. I can't do boring. Uh-huh. Anything but boring. Sorry for interrupting you.
Well, also, I like to tag stuff too. This is like an acting thing where you say something extra at the end, or you just basically keep the scene going. Sometimes I'll just do that. It's like, I'm just going to stay in the scene until they tell me to stop.
Right.
And that's a fun thing to do, because you end up being like, hey, I'm in this character so much that I don't even, like, we're not, this words are great, but those words were just the beginning of the thing. It's like getting the kite off the ground, like they're running to get the kite off, but now the wind's gone, and just, you could go forever, really.
Yeah, I want to go back to that. I wanted to mention, you talked about casting directors. It's one of my dreams to have, to interview Allison Jones.
Oh, cool. Right? Yeah, she's great.
I mean, have you met her?
I auditioned for her a lot.
Have you?
Yeah. Actually, I auditioned for her for Superbad before I even knew. This is still to this day something where I kick myself over. I'm like, oh, man, Pemberton, what if you took acting classes like 2 years early?
Uh-huh.
Who knows what you'd be doing right now?
Yeah.
Because I was like, do I look under the camera? She's like, no, you don't.
That's amazing.
And I was, oh, shoot. which probably wouldn't have mattered, but I was too green to, I don't know. I just didn't have enough balls to really commit to something at that point.
Right,
but,
yeah.
Yeah, I've auditioned for a bunch.
I want to talk about committing, but I also just want to say, casting director, one of the reasons I want to meet her and other casting directors is purely because I love the idea of someone who has made it their business to spot someone's, not potential, but more like true self of like, because I think a lot about Judd Apatow talking about when he'll see somebody who other people don't see as like a main,
as a lead, right.
And be like, well, what would their movie be? And talking about Steve Carell and all kinds of other people. Because I think Steve at the time, I don't think anybody saw him being the lead.
Well, he was in, he was in Bruce Almighty. He had that role that popped.
Yes, yeah.
It made like Jim Carrey go like, oh no.
Yeah, I bet. Oh. He stole the friggin' show.
Turn that down, turn the volume down a bit on the scene.
I imagine this. Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. But I love that idea. It's probably just about wanting to be seen on an emotional level, this is like a psychological thing of mine probably, but I just want to meet them because I'm just like, you are so good. She especially is so good at spotting who this person is or what they should play or whatever. Have you experienced any of that? Or you were kind of talking about casting directors. I just wondered if that was part of it. Have you ever had anybody spot anything in you that you didn't already know yourself?
I mean, I don't know if they've said it. I've had people bring me in a ton for everything. I never booked anything through them, but they always bring me in.
Right.
Like, why am I in for this? This isn't me. I'm not supposed to read for this. Like, I just want to see what you do with it.
Yeah.
There's also a dark side of that.
Why?
To where a lot of times what they will do is they'll read someone funny for something, and then they will steal what they did, and it goes in the movie or the show. Because you sign an NDA.
All right.
It's like, if you say something super funny on top of what we've written,
yikes.
It's ours now.
Is that pretty common?
Yeah.
Oh,
it's had to happen a lot.
Yikes.
But it's a compliment, I guess.
Right, sure, yeah.
Because it's not like...
You got to be pretty resilient, I guess, with all this stuff.
Oh, it's like insanely resilient. I was just thinking the other day, it's the only job where you have to be the most sensitive and also the most tough.
That's one of the things I think about all the time with the sensitivity of actors, of having to be so soft, so emotional.
Oh, yeah.
And you watch, someone, I don't know if you, being an actor, would defend this, but, like the thing of Christian Bale flipping out on the...
Oh, I would I definitely defend him.
I listen to it and I think, to do what he's doing and get into that place, it just makes sense to me. I was like, of course, you're right on the edge.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
I mean... People blow that out of proportion.
Yeah, sure. For people that don't know, I'm just referring to there's like a video or audio of Christian Bale flipping on a camera guy. Like
I think it was a lighting guy.
A lighting guy. Yeah. Okay, yeah. So he's like
even worse.
Freaking out. Like, right.
Oh, I had to have. I almost had one of those moments, but I didn't say anything, and it really bothered me that I didn't say anything.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, it was something where I should have just gone ballistic. I should have just been like,
What?
I was a camera guy.
Yeah.
The director called action. And this camera guy who was a camera assistant, and he was taking like a joke selfie. And I'm saying words, and I'm looking at this guy, and he's doing that. I was so angry. It was like so angry I wasn't angry.
Yeah.
So angry like I had to be like, oh man. But like, oh, just the sheer disrespect is just like something where
outrageous.
Oh my God, I could swim across English Channel with the rage.
There's probably something about if you're not doing that, not understanding what it takes to do acting or comedy, not understanding it just in terms of an emotional level of vulnerability, going up there, all that. And I imagine they're like, oh, what are they doing? They're just up there saying lines or whatever. But yikes.
Yeah. What,
you go ahead.
Well, because it feels like a factory a lot of times. TV production can feel kind of monotonous. So I can see how people can think that.
Right. Yeah. You talk about committing. You've talked about it a few times last time we talked, and also I wanted to talk about that and also confidence, because I think going into a room and talking back to somebody, I've listened to your podcast and I've thought a lot about, I'm very envious of when I'm on stage. I find it fine. I can be my full self,
right?
But lots of smaller groups and even one-on-one, I have a hard time just being myself, being confident, whatever. And I imagine going in or if I go into a meeting, this is something that anybody listening to this will relate to. Going to a meeting that matters to you, you're afraid about it or whatever. Is it natural for you? Or what have you learned things about it? Both in committing and confidence, because I think they're similar in a way.
I mean, I don't know. I guess it depends. I think the thing with the large groups, a lot of comedians and actors who are very shy, and there's something about having a large group and performing in a way that you know what you're going to do that makes those people not very shy.
Uh-huh.
And like you're saying, a smaller group is different because there's a real interactive component as opposed to a performative one direction kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so I guess in terms of like a meeting or something like that, I just always... I don't know. I guess I just like to always approach things with energy. And also, I always think about if anything bad happens, it's a good thing. I remember one time I was doing a big set at the Improv. This was my early on in comedy. And I was really nervous. And the woman who was running the ticket office, I accidentally bumped into her. And she was really mean to me. And also, I was like really shy. So it was hard for me to say, like, I'm like, what are you doing here? It's like, I'm performing on the show. I'm here. I think it was like, wait, what? What's your name? Like, just being really short and mean to me.
Yeah.
And I kept thinking like, okay, I just have to decide this is a good sign. Because if I don't, it's going to get in my head and it's going to throw me off balance and I'm going to have a bad show. So a lot of times now, if there's anything bad or what I consider unlucky, I'm like, ooh, this is good.
Right.
This is a good thing. This means something good's going to happen.
Yeah.
It means I can also...
What makes you... convince yourself of that? How do you?
I just,
what do you
decide
just
it's true.
Yeah,
I right. just like, okay, this woman was a total B to me.
Yeah,
and I'm gonna just make that be like, oh, that's. I mean, later on, I learned that it's. Oh, she's not being mean to me. She's angry about something else, and she's taken
sure,
out.
Yeah, right.
But I didn't really have that sort of awareness at the time.
Yeah,
from reading the four agreements. So right. I just take it like, oh, this is bad. Anything bad is just something that. It's further going to galvanize your ability to make something really great. And I think that show was something where, I don't know, it may have been like a Fox showcase I did that kind of like gave me a bunch. I think it was one of those things where industry showcases are notoriously terrible.
Yeah.
People just don't laugh
because
it's like they've seen everything and they're jaded and they have to be there. And I think I used to open with a character a lot and I do it for like 2 or 3 minutes. Super aggressive character, like a guy from New York who's an idiot talking about spiders.
Right.
I would do that, and I did that. They didn't vet my set; they didn't see what it was. And I went up there, and I just like, I didn't so much crush it as I did, sometimes I'll just go up there and be like, I don't care, give a shit about anything. I'm just going to destroy you.
Yeah.
With what I have. Like, my friend Michelle Balloon, she probably gave me the best advice with comedy I've ever heard. I was bitching about something or other. Yeah. She's like, sometimes you just have to shove your comedy down people's throats.
Yeah.
And I think about that. I'm like, okay, sometimes you just have to be like, you have to just destroy people to the point where they're listening and they submit to what you have as being good.
Uh-huh.
And not everybody, some people can do that with physical presence, like a big dude goes up there and he's really quiet.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes people will just respect him out of that. But for me, I'm like, I look like this, like a 12-year-old who's lost. So I have to go up there and just be, oh, you think I'm some shy little weak guy?
I could destroy you. Yeah.
I will kill you right now. I will die. I will kill myself to kill you right now.
Right.
If you even try to not laugh at this.
Yes.
So it's like a thing where, I don't know, you just have to be like committed to the point where you're just destroying the people. And that, I think that's what I just did, because I just didn't care. Honestly, I didn't care about the fact it was an industry showcase. I just wanted to just destroy it, just to burn it down.
Yeah.
And I think that's like a thing where, I think it's a thing where the metric of success for a lot of things is skewed. And I feel like for me, that metric wasn't there. I didn't care. I was like, nothing's going to come from this. The only thing that's going to come from this is me doing a good job and feeling good about doing that good job.
Uh-huh.
Not about like, oh, you killed the Funk Showcase. Maybe we'd like to cast you as this thing.
Yeah.
Like that kind of thing, which I think gets in a lot of people's heads because they think, see, that's such an opportunity.
Yes. That's never a good thing.
No.
You never want to. That's something that I've gotten better at. I think the less desperate I've been.
Yeah.
When I was starting out, I was way more desperate for anything. And that desperation always kills all of your opportunities. And if you go into everything with walk away power and you're like, well, I'm just going to do as good as I can do. And it'll be fun to do that.
Totally.
Yeah.
That's the irony with so much art, especially performing, is that they want people to do a job who are people who don't want to do a job.
Mm. Right. Totally true.
Like,
yeah.
I'm up here being so like, true. Hey, good luck hiring me. I wake up late and I like to throw my food.
Yes.
We would like you to work on this thing that costs a lot of money and requires you to do certain rules. Oh, you can't do that at work.
Right, yeah.
It's like you're hiring a clown.
Yes.
To do like a corporate retreat kind of thing.
And even just that whole, I mean, work versus play, I think the open versus closed mode idea of like, they literally can't exist in the same space.
Yeah.
So they have to dance to make
sort of
creative work that, you know, is in commerce. They're going to have to figure out how to exist together.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as you're working, you're not playing.
I don't feel like that's true though for me.
Let me hear it.
I feel like if you're not playing at work, you're not doing your job.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying is that they're asking a person who is a professional player to come into work.
Yeah.
And I think if you're in the mindset, basically what I'm saying is, I feel like productivity in the traditional sense is basically the opposite of creativity.
Totally.
If they don't, you can't have them in the same space.
Yeah, like, if you do, it's an accident.
Right, yes. And like there's a, the thing that kind of made me switch on to that was there's a video of John Cleese. Ever seen these?
He's just talking
about creativity and the science behind it, and just talks about open mode versus closed mode and how he would trick himself, the methods he would use to trick himself to write Monty Python or whatever, which were go into a room and play for 2 hours, and the only metric is, was it fun?
Right.
And never, the metric is never result in a good show. And that's why he's always like, lots of time is good for it, to where you can waste tons of time.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
I think in that same thing, I heard David Lynch, the person who taught him how to paint, his painting teacher said, I need 4 hours to get in 1 hour of good painting.
Yeah. Yes.
It's always the same thing. You just need so much time to mess and to fool and to be an idiot. And sometimes, I mean, just going back to acting or performing, I think a lot of that, for me, when I've had success with things, it's because in rehearsing, really playing around with things significantly, like trying it
yeah.
a really dumb way. I'd never do it, but just for fun of it, just to see what you find. Because sometimes you like light up a corner that you didn't know was there that you can use in the thing that's not that corner.
Yep. And I think working with business people, workers that understand that is pretty essential.
Like, yeah.
They're hard to find. They don't.
Oh, yeah. It's hard to find that. Someone who's can be complimentary to like a clown wrangler.
Yeah, exactly. So what, okay, we're on the home stretch here. What's exciting to you now in terms of, I really want to, the question is ambiguous, but I just want to know, like, and maybe we'll have you on again and we'll finish the story because okay. we didn't really go through everything.
Yeah, I mean, it's a long story, but also it's one of those things are just things just gradual
pieces together. Yeah, it's just, you know, it's interesting to me. But right now in your everyday life, what are you thinking about in terms of your creativity, what you want to do, writing? What are you excited about? You got any breakthroughs, new philosophies? I could keep talking, but
I'm excited about doing my podcast. I like doing that because it's like a thing where there's no stakes. I get really excited about doing this character named Dicker Troy.
I saw a little bit of that.
Yeah, yeah. I stream with him. So I've been trying to just start streaming, which again is like a thing. I've never done it before.
Yeah.
I'm excited about trying to change things up because I feel like I've sort of been, not in a rut, but there's a lot of stuff that I've been doing I've already done a bunch.
Uh-huh.
And as dumb as it sounds, or maybe as callous or arrogant or whatever you want to call it, like I worked on TV shows a lot to the point where, like, I love acting as a job.
Uh-huh.
It just doesn't fill up the cup all the way.
Yeah.
It doesn't fill.
That's illustration for me. So I like illustration. To you know, I find a lot of parallels between acting and illustration more than anything else. More than comedy. Comedy to me, writing.
Yeah, my wife's an illustrator.
Yeah.
And we've been together for a long time. I think that's part of the reason we get along so well is we can talk about something that's very similar without it being the same thing. So it's kind of like...
So it's not competitive.
Yeah, not competitive, but we definitely understand each other. So yes. sleepybrit.store.
Boom! I'll put it in the show notes. Yeah. And but I find illustration and acting, they both seem very intuitive, not very cerebral in a way where it's feeling and you're kind of... Some illustrators are obviously doing more conceptual stuff, but I love doing that.
Right.
But it doesn't really tickle me in terms of writing something that has some kind of payoff or the kind of whatever you get out of that. So I can relate to that.
Well, that's my thing, I guess, right now. So I'm trying to figure out, because so much of what I used to do and have done is kind of endorphin-based, which is not the best, most sustainable way to be doing things.
You mean just like the
getting excited about it?
So you're, yeah.
And it takes a lot more to get me excited now. And I can't get excited now just from doing stand-up because I'm doing that. I'm living, I do a stand-up show. I feel better afterwards because it's like therapy.
Yeah.
But I shouldn't be, that's one-off things. That's not working toward a bigger thing. So for me right now, I'm really trying to get all my S together. Stands for, you know, the bad.
What?
I'm trying to get all my crap together. Right. Shit.
Right. Oh, okay. Is that some kind of term?
Yeah, we say, I'm trying to get my ass together. It's pretty H. Pretty hard. I'm just trying to get it all together so I can formulate more things that are personal and committed that aren't an immediate payoff thing, which is hard for me.
Me too.
It's really hard. So it's about writing.
Yes.
And writing is something where I realize I've done a lot of writing in the sense where I've written a lot of material for myself.
Jokes and stuff, yeah.
I've done a lot of writing with others. Like I've written a bunch of pilots and things like that. So that's great, but I've never really gotten in the weeds and written something for myself to be a part of because I'm at this point now where, my nose is making a whistle sound. A lot of people know me and stuff in terms of like people who would hire me.
Yeah.
And there's not, if something isn't what they've seen me do before, it's hard to make the case to hire. So I realize I just have to, I've been telling myself this for a while.
Yeah.
I have to build something for myself in a new voice.
Yeah.
that hasn't been seen before, and I have to do it regardless of whether or not I'm currently experiencing financial success or a financial a pause. Because I feel like I'm always, I kind of had a realization where, like when I was freaking out last year about not working.
Yeah.
And then I booked this show that was on I Feel Bad. I booked it. It happened super fast and just really, really great and cool. And I love working with those people, everything. I just realized, oh, I'm always probably going to be able to get some work, whether something. I like it or not.
Yeah,
it's
going
to keep coming unless I just literally say no to everything. It's going to be, like I have agents.
You've got
and
that ball rolling now. Yeah. That plate is spinning.
I'm insurable.
And you can, you're right.
I'm highly insurable. I've never been late. I've never had to stop down production for me. I've never done anything that causes an insurance issue on set, which is an actual thing.
Like, oh, I didn't know that.
You can be a great actor, but if you aren't insurable, like Lindsay Lohan's a great prime example. She's a great actress, but if you don't show up, they can't get in production insurance. They can't get production insurance. They can't get it made.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I never knew that.
It's sad.
Yeah,
it's truly sad.
That is sad.
So if you're really insurable, you will work. If you want to work. You may not work a ton. You may not be making the bank you did before, but you will get enough money to probably eat.
Yes, right.
So, like, the idea of worrying about that is so... It's like in the middle of winter worrying that it's not going to be a spring.
Right, yes.
And because I'm a big gardener, so there's a lot of metaphors with plants I think about all the time. It's kind of crazy the degree with which those metaphors translate. It's some kind of thing where you realize, oh, everything is exactly the same. There's no difference.
There's only one thing.
You know that song by Donny Hathaway, Everything is Everything?
No, but maybe I do, but...
Old soul song from 75.
Yeah, I know it. I just can't think of what. Yeah, I definitely know it. But that's like a big spiritual.
Yeah, everything is
principles.
Everything.
It's all one thing. Yeah.
So I think about that, and I just realize, okay, if that's the case, then I have to do stuff I've never done before if I want to do things I haven't. If I want to achieve things I haven't had before.
Yes.
So it's just a matter of doing that, and it's hard. I've done some stuff lately. I'm working on something that's kind of getting some traction. I feel really good about it. It's just like it's the whole thing of doing something that you don't get immediate gratification from.
Yeah.
Which is, it's really hard, especially if you're a comedian, because you want that so badly.
You want the laugh, you want the endorphins, whatever. Artists, yeah, you want that. You want someone to, love you, basically.
Right.
But for the longest time, I could not get into that mode, and it wasn't until, it was more about, making books and stuff that it wasn't until I decided when I come up with something that's totally my thing, I have to think of it as, I'm going to make this thing, whether or not any gatekeeper lets me.
Yeah, totally.
Because if I'm writing it to pitch it, it's never good. It sucks.
Yeah, because you're pandering and you're not thinking about, like all the great works of literature, not so much literature, but stuff that's really loved by critics and fans alike.
Yeah.
The Hobbit.
Right.
Tolkien wrote that for his kid.
Yes.
What's your name? The Harry Potter.
J.K. Rowling.
J.K. wrote that for her daughter?
Right. I don't know.
Wrote it for someone she loved.
I've done the same thing. And I start thinking about, there's a middle reader book I want to write. And it wasn't even, and I don't have time to do that right now, but that not even a possibility until I thought, I could write this for my son. He'd love it. And I just start writing a little bit, and you're like, this is the only way in. There's no way other way into this.
Because it's that perfect blend of anything you do for him, he'll love it.
Right.
But then also, he's going to love it. So, I'm going to work hard on it, so he'll love it even more.
Yes, and I know what he loves.
Yeah.
I know, and I'll put that in there. And I think the other thing that will stop me from making good work when I'm trying to make something to pitch is the whole time there's the voice of, is this even going to be worth it? Like, are they going to like it? Like, are they going to, even if I pitch it to 100 people, am I ever going to get the book deal? And so there's just that thing of like, you feel like I'm wasting my life. Like, I've got to make this fast.
Dude, that's the worst. I got in that last year. There's nothing worse in this entire world than trying to rush to do something. I got to do something great.
That's
terrible.
100%. And I think one of the things, I've been trying to shut that off too, of like, I think, what does yours come from? wanting to do it fast?
Oh, just because I don't know. I have a real, like, serious patience problem.
Right, me too.
It's terrible. I think it comes from having a bowel disease for real. It's like having to rush to the bathroom and missing out on things when you're in the bathroom, that kind of crap.
Yeah.
I think that's part of it. And then it's just been endemic and kind of like found its way into my bones. And
yeah,
I find myself like, what am I in a rush for? Who yes. cares?
Yeah.
I hate it. I hate it so much. It's just the most trash ever is rush.
And that's rushing. The thing about, we, you know, talking earlier about creativity taking time,
uh-huh.
is that this is something I've been really trying to turn down that rushing thing. And I think part of me is thinking, oh, I've got to do this thing before someone else does it. And I do
totally.
And I feel, this is a new theory of mine where I'm just like, I don't want to make creative work out of that. Like if someone yeah. comes and makes a version that's somewhat similar to what I want to do, I'm still going to do my thing.
Yeah.
Because they're not going to do it like me. And I just don't think that, I just think it's unproductive and not as toxic.
There's also, I heard something similar to that, that was something like, okay, if you don't make the thing you want to make right now, if you don't just do it to do it, you have to give it up. And if someone else does make something like that, it's because you didn't.
Right. I've heard this too. Yeah.
You don't own anything.
Same thing, yeah.
It's going to go away and someone else is going to be like, oh, it's going to land on their shoulder and they're going to, ah, this is cool. I like this butterfly.
Yeah.
And if you don't capture the butterfly, we're trying to say here, guys, you got to capture the butterfly.
You got to capture the butterfly. I've been trying to be like, you know what? I don't care. If it goes to somebody else, they're going to put it in their voice and that'll be fine.
Yeah.
And I'll still do mine. And it just doesn't, the one thing I know, I can't rush. And so that's
been super bad. It's terrible. That happens a lot of times in like productions is they rush stuff. And I'll work 21 hours. I don't care.
Yeah.
My favorite thing ever is seeing a director argue with the line producer.
Why?
Because it's like, the line producer is like, okay, we gotta move on. We gotta get this. And he's like, no, we have to do 15 more takes of this. Remember seeing that one time, there's this great director named Tor Frodenthal I worked on something with, and he just seemed argue like hell with the line producer all the time.
Yeah.
She was just so, just frustrated with him because it would just take so long. And this is one of the first things I ever worked on. I just didn't, like, I don't have a place to go.
Right, yeah.
Let's just keep doing it.
Yeah.
Do 1,000 times. Who cares? It's all because of money.
Oh, because you...
The line producer's in charge of the money, so they're like, the longer we do this thing, we can't do that thing. But everything goes over time, always. Everything, everything takes forever.
It does. Well, thanks for doing this, man. I want to do a round two because there's more. There's a bunch of stuff I want to ask you about.
This podcast is great. It's one of the few podcasts I actually listen to.
That means a lot to me, man. Yeah. It really does.
It's awesome.
Awesome!
Peace.
Thanks, Johnny, for being on the show. I hope we get to hang out again soon, man. And I hope you get to be on the show again. Go check out Johnny's wife's illustrations at Sleepy Brittany on Instagram. And go follow Johnny Pemberton on Instagram. And go listen to his podcast, Live to Tape. It is a comedy podcast. He does tons of a lot of vocal effects and weird stuff, but he is so freaking hilarious. I could listen to this guy talk all day. Thanks for being on the show, man. And thank you to Yoni Wolf and the band Y for our theme music. Thanks to Chris Graham of Chris Graham Mastering for production assistance and mastering of this show. Thanks to Alex Sugg for providing the soundtrack to this show. You can go listen to the soundtrack on Spotify or Apple Music. Creative Pep Talk Original Soundtrack Volume 1. Really good music for, you know, getting into the groove. It's instrumental. You're going to like it. It's epic. It's fun. It's got little squinkies and squonkies going on. Go check it out. Thank you so much for listening to this show. And until we speak again, stay pepped up. Thank you.